seminar. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce our remote speaker, Professor Tom Adams from McMaster University in the Chemical Engineering Department. Professor Adams has a lot of experience on the topic that he's going to talk about today. He received a dual bachelor's degree in chemical engineering and computer science from Michigan State University. Then he went on to work with Professor Warren Cedar at the University of Pennsylvania, and then worked with Paul Barton at MIT as a postdoc. And what's interesting in all of those cases is he was very deeply into process systems engineering, and more specifically into process synthesis. Working at MIT with Professor Barton, he worked on a major BP project that dealt with advanced power systems. And with these advanced power systems, he was looking at fossil fuel power generation and carbon capture, and synthesized a number of interesting processes for these involving some new technologies. Since moving on to McMaster University, he's continued this work and expanded it in a number of different ways, and he'll be talking about that today. In particular, he'll be talking about future polygeneration systems. So, Tom, it's all yours.
Thanks a lot. No, I think that's a great introduction. So I'm going to go ahead and skip the second slide and go straight to slide three.
Okay.
So this is a pretty classic introduction slide, I think. I think I've given similar talks with basically the same slides. I've seen 100 like it, right, where we have a list of bullet points about CO2 causing global warming as our motivation, and we get bonus points if we cite, you know, the IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change report for doing that, pictures of cuddly polar bears and so forth. Basically we're looking at the same thing, right? Where I'm motivated by coming up with systems that can basically try to solve the energy crisis, looking at economics, environmental impact, and government impact. So, everyone uses the same introduction. I'm hearing a large echo. If somebody has could hit their mute button, if they have a speaker on, that would probably help a lot. Okay, so I'm moving on to slide four, where basically I want to show my motivation for here. So when I started here at McMaster, I was presented with something that we call the Toronto problem. Okay, and the idea is that everybody wants clean energy, right? I think if you ask somebody, do you want clean energy, they all say yes. I don't think that's at all a surprise to anybody. But the challenge is it costs money, or else it's inconvenient, or there's something else that's really stopping us from, really getting there. Okay, so the problem we have specifically here in the Toronto area is that we need more power, all right? We're growing rapidly. And at the same time, our existing fossil fuel power generation fleet is aging. So the provincial government recently voted to shut down all of our coal plants, for example, and not replace them. So they're old, 40, 50 years. You know, that part isn't at all surprising. But essentially they said, okay, we're going to use wind power. Okay. So we've rejected the idea that we're going to do more fossil fuels, and then in general, the people were very supportive of wind. There's always detractors, but essentially that was where the movement went. Okay, and so what the plan was instead of replacing an existing fuel plant, fossil fuel plant at its existing source where we already have the infrastructure, any kind of new wind would have to go in, basically spread across the province, and that requires a considerable amount of new transmission lines. Okay, so we have, we go with this, space, low energy density power source. And what happened was the people protested against the installing of the transmission lines. Okay, so those permits never happened and the wind farms were never built. So we're right back to where we started again. So this is a great example of what we're facing, just in terms of, even if we have the technology and we have the willing to pay, because we're actually all paying here in Ontario a surtax on our energy bills just for this wind project that never happened. Okay, so, but at the same time, there's other details that are in. So the goal of my group is to try to come up with ways that satisfy everybody. Now, that's the golden goose. You know, it's going to probably never achieve the true solution, but that's where we're working. So we work on the context of the triple bottom line of sustainability. So I'm on slide five. Okay, so this is how we define it, and this is basically recognizing that we have three separate tiers of impact that we have to consider. So we have economics, you know, money matters, it's got to make money, it can't be that expensive. We have balancing with, you know, job creation, all of that stuff that goes into economics. The environment, of course, there's a long list of things we care about. Primarily in this presentation, I'll just focus on CO2 as opposed to the full life cycle. But all of these things are important. And then society, so not just public policy, government regulations, but will people accept it? Is it safe? And election, you know, people getting elected is one of the primary driving forces for a lot of the policies. What do you think they'll increase their chances for election, which is really where we're ending up. Okay, so what I did was I went and I tried to take a look at, okay, what are some great projects that are working under the triple bottom line idea? And so I'm on slide six now. And I really didn't have to go very much farther than the ESI seminar series you've already had here. So here's a long list of, and I went through all of the past presentations and I tried to figure out, okay, well, how does this impact the triple bottom line? And basically they all do. Whether it's biofuels, using fossil fuels responsibly, integrating renewables, technical challenges, tools like optimization, all of these things are important. Okay, so what I'm going to try to do today is talk about my work in the context of the triple bottom line, but I'm going to pretty much skip anything that I do that we've already covered in this seminar series. So I'm going to focus today on future energy systems. So what are the key technologies which enable us to do great things with the system? Okay, and so we're looking at, this presentation focuses on future, so 20, 30 years out. What's the up-and-coming technology, what is the world going to look like in terms of energy? Okay, so now slide seven, I'm going to talk about solid oxide fuel cells, and I think Larry's introduction mentioned I worked with this system at MIT. It's a great introduction to how one enabling technology can let us do a lot of things with this system. Okay, so on slide eight, if you're not familiar with an SOFC, it's not like a PEM, it's not like a hydrogen-powered fuel cell where hydrogen diffuses through a membrane and it reacts in the air side. Okay, so the way this one works is we have, usually it's a bulk stationary type design meant for stationary power. We can use it for other things, but essentially we take air, put it in the cathode, and then oxygen will react with electrons in a circuit to form oxygen ions, and then those are conducted through the solid oxide electrolyte. So that's the wall separating the anode and the cathode. All right. And then what happens is it's, instead of diffusing through a membrane, oxygen will actually bump in to the edge of the wall, and that knocks the next one down, and that knocks the next one down, and so on in the series until one pops out the back into the anode. Okay, so it's like electrons conducting in a wire, except it's a solid-state ion conductor. Okay, so once we're in the anode side, then our oxygen ions react with our fuel, and that releases electrons with the high voltage, the high potential energy. So that's where we get our energy. It's converted from the bonds of the fuel, chemical bonds, into electric potential. Okay, so there's a couple of key features here. I have four on the slide that really make this particular system good from a systems perspective. Okay, one of the nice things I guess I should mention is that it's fuel flexible. We can use natural gas, we can use coal syngas, biomass syngas, we can use diesel, methanol. There's a lot of things that we can do here. All right, but the key systems features are that we can operate at high pressure, so we can go up to 20 bar. And I'll explain how all these relate later. Another one is it's just efficient, 60 to percent electrical efficiency. That's good in itself. Even though it doesn't seem that high, but it's great from a systems perspective. Another one is high temperature. That's both a good thing and a bad thing. That's a bad thing from the perspective as it's more expensive to deal with the materials and the other complexities around high temperature. But on the other hand, from a systems perspective, you get a high exergy waste product, right? High temperature heat is valuable. And then the last one, this is really key, is that the outlets of the anode and cathode can be kept separate. They're not mixed. And what this lets us do, slide nine now, is this means we can build an energy or a power system with CO2 capture being essentially almost a trivial part. Okay. So we can take air, compress it, put it in the cathode. All right, and so the depleted air, then, we can expand back through a Brayton cycle turbine. And because I mentioned we have this high temperature heat as a waste product, we actually generate electricity just from a Brayton cycle using a fuel cell as a heating source. Okay, so there's additional energy to pre-produce from the cell just from that Brayton cycle. And then it's still hot enough to use in a heat exchanger network for a secondary steam cycle, a combined cycle, or cogeneration for hot water or whatever. All right, and in the fuel side, in the anode side, our fuel then, it may or may not be fully oxidized. We go with about 80% utilization. If we can oxidize the remaining unreacted fuel catalytically, and then when we're all done, we have a stream that's nothing but water and CO2. Okay, because we never mix it with our air, it's very easy to capture the CO2. We just condense out the water. So we can recover our waste heat, and then we just end up with a stream of CO2 and water. And this is really cool. So all the carbon basically starts in the fuel, and it just goes through the system, and there's really no place for it to go but in our captured CO2 stream. And so we can basically get 100% CO2 capture at high pressure. So that's great, because now we're getting CO2 at, you know, it's only 1/6 of pipeline pressure, about 120 bars. So whether we sell it for an ants oil recovery or we just sequester it, our compression costs are a lot lower than from, like, pulverized coal, if you want to do post-combustion capture, that kind of thing. And then we get water. So this water is actually ultra-high purity. And you can do some treatment, but people have actually drunk this. So I talked to someone at the DOE that they actually took a glass of water from the fuel cell exhaust. And actually astronauts in the space shuttle do this when they use a hydrogen fuel. So this is really cool, because they actually produce water from our fossil fuel. So there's a lot of really great things that just come out of the fact that the SOFC has those properties. Okay, so on slide 10 now, that leads us to a number of superstructures, like different systems we can do. And so what we're looking at is, okay, I can use the fuel cell in the center, and I could use natural gas, coal, or biomass in any combination. And, you know, depending on how I do cleaning and I do pretreatment and all the heat integration, so there's a lot of options here. And then downstream, I can choose between, you know, doing oxidation with carbon capture, or I can do a gas turbine, or I can just burn. I can integrate with hot water heating, cogeneration, you know, a secondary steam cycle. There's a lot of options. Okay, so that one device lets us do a lot with it. And so what I can do is, if I just want to do, let's say, power with CO2 capture, I'm on slide 11 now, just taking a look at the efficiencies of the system. All right, so on the left side, we have our coal-based fuels, and blue means we're not implementing carbon capture, and green means we are. Okay, so we have boiler and gas turbine in the center of the coal at about 38% efficient. That's like traditional pulverized coal, and that would be IGCC for the gas turbine one. If we add carbon capture, we drop down to like 25-30% efficiency. So that's a huge penalty. And that's what comes from absorption-based CO2 capture. These are systems that are not conducive to CO2 capture, and so it is hard. Okay, we spend a lot of energy to do that. But with the fuel cell, we can get up to, you know, 42-43% efficient, and we have about a 1 percentage point penalty. So for CO2 capture, it's very small. And that's because the SOFC enables us to do better CO2 capture. And on the natural gas side, it's even, you know, more significant. We can get up to, you know, 73-74% efficient from a higher heating value perspective. At lower heating value, it's like 80%. Okay. And these are just different options we have here for the upstream stuff. But basically, you can just see from an efficiency perspective what happens to the system when we integrate all these together. Page 12 now. And when you look at the CO2 emissions, you know, this is, you can see directly here what we're talking about. So these are for plants that are scaled for about 700 megawatts. That's about one Hamilton, Ontario in size. But from traditional pulverized coal, we're looking at 5 megaton per year of CO2. We drop down to just above 4 for a fuel cell without carbon capture. That's just from the efficiency. That's just the fact that we need less of it to produce the same power. When we add carbon capture, you know, for pulverized coal, we can get rid of about 80% on a per megawatt basis. But with the fuel cell, we go down to effectively 0. Same thing for the natural gas side. So we can really just tackle that problem right up front with the integrated system. And then on slide 13 is the water consumption. So we consume less water, again, compared to IGCC in this case. with the fuel cell just for efficiency purposes. But if we capture the CO2 and we get that water as well, we actually have a net negative water consumption. So we are producing 1 billion liters of water per year with coal and 1.5 with natural gas. Okay, so just think about what that does in terms of the water problem, which we haven't really talked about in this presentation. But, you know, as we go forward in the future, water is increasingly a concern. And here we're actually making water from our fossil fuels. So that's a great way to harmonize our electricity production with another important environmental need. Okay. All right, I'm going to talk about, on slide 14, by the way, talk about compressed air energy storage. So the fuel cell system is promising in itself, but one of the problems is that for the bulk scale, it's expected to be basically a steady state process. It's going to be a baseline, base load providing power source. So what I'm trying to do is find a way to integrate this for flexible power. Okay, for load following peaking power. All right, so right now, for example, we can use coal and nuclear for baseline, and then we'll often use the natural gas firing for peaking power purposes, right, to meet the greater loads during the day versus night. Okay, so for compressed air energy storage, what this does, this is a way where we take this happens right now. There's two plants doing this right now where either they have extra power or they buy power when it's cheap, and they just compress air and they stick it in the ground. Okay, and there are natural reservoirs, or you can make a reservoir to do this. And then when they need the power or they want to sell it at high prices, they pull it back out, they preheat and then expand through turbines to make the electricity. And they can do this with fast dynamics, so you can actually load follow and you can meet minute-by-minute demand with, you know, turns of the valve, and they're very, very fast dynamics here. So this is going on for purely economic purposes in two places, but it turns out it's a great system to integrate with the fuel cells, because with the fuel cell system, I'm on slide 15 now, okay, we just happen to have compressed air as a waste product. Okay, so what this means is we can build a system where we have the SOFC and CO2 capture system running at steady state. Okay, so we don't have to mess around with trying to turn this up and down and damaging the fuel cells. All right, and then we can just take this compressed air and we store it when we need it. And then if we need to pull it back out of the ground, then we do that, and we just run our compressed air through a Brayton cycle turbine. Okay, so just by diverting this airstream, we can sort of do that with a very fast response rate. And so then what we can do is we can actually match a very realistic power demand profile. Okay, so on the bottom right, this is a real power demand for Ontario, and I've scaled it to Hamilton size over the course of a week, and this is sort of hour-by-hour information. And you can see it goes up and down, but there's all these little peaks and bumps along the way. So there's daily trends, there's weekly trends, and there's seasonal trends, right? There's a lot. But what's really cool is we can build this system where if I build the fuel cell system to sort of meet an average peak, this big middle line here, this double line, the compressed air that I use for the fuel cell is actually just the right amount where I can deviate from that peak to meet the highs and lows as I need. Okay. And again, I could do all this with 100% carbon capture. So this little shaded box, I sort of pull this out to show you, we actually have real-time information where we can predict the next 24 hours of demand on an hour-by-hour basis, okay, with an uncertainty of about 6% at the 24-hour period, and it's more and more certain as you get toward the period, okay? So what this means is I can use real-time optimization even with this uncertainty considered, all right? And on slide 16, when we do this, we can actually match this profile with about 99.5% accuracy. Okay, so the black lines are my real demand, and the red lines are what my system is actually doing. And now you can see it's stepping. In reality, we transition. We're just doing hour-long increments for the study. But what we can do is it shows that we don't need any extra air or any extra stuff to run the system. It actually matches very, very well. And what's cool is, you know, the real-time optimizer is smart enough that if it sees that I'm going to run out of storage space, it knows that ahead of time I'm gonna go ahead and overproduce a little bit. Okay, so that way I can sell this power at maybe a reduced price, or just dissipate it, but it does so in a smooth fashion, so that way my total deviation is actually quite small, like sort of sum of squared error difference. And at the same time, if it sees I'm going to run out, it'll, instead of just spontaneously running out and having, you know, a sudden drop in output, it'll slowly and very smoothly underproduce for a little while. Okay, so that means I have a very nice, well-controlled, smooth system. And so the system integration works very, very well to meet those real demands. Okay, so on slide 17, this is what's going on in the cavern. So we just have this underground cavern, and we just, you know, the 40 bars are minimum pressure, that means empty. 72 would be our maximum pressure, that would be full. And our real-time optimizer is good enough where, in the optimal cases, and this is, again, using just these 24-hour predictions, which are available and have uncertainty, a good optimizer just barely touches these curves instead of lingering, just touches these boundaries. Okay, so it's a very graceful and nice way to sort of meet that real demand. And you can see this is actually a lot smoother than the real demand. Okay, the real demand is up and down, and it's peaking. But here, in actuality, we have a very nice, smooth system. Okay, so on slide 18, we take a look at our CO2 emissions, and here we're concerned about both direct and indirect. Direct means something I emit. Indirect means I had to buy electricity because I didn't make enough. So I had to buy that off the grid. So we account for those emissions, and basically with our integrated system, we can basically get zero direct and indirect emissions, essentially. Just a little bit of indirect from those few times that I don't quite meet it. Okay, but what this means is now we can take really high efficiency, zero emissions power for peaking purposes from fossil fuel. So that's pretty incredible. And that's what's really neat about these systems. So now we want to take a look at costs. So I'm on slide 19 now. And because, again, we need to look at all aspects of the triple bottom line. So what we're looking at is a DOE from their website where they're trying to bring down the cost of SOFCs. So from commercially right now, you can buy them at about $47,000 a kilowatt at the 250 kilowatt scale. So they're on the market, but the problem is they're not manufactured in bulk such that the price is low and the scales are big enough yet. So that's why we're talking about future systems. Okay, so this graph shows us that they expect that at today's SOFC designs, using our current anodes, interconnects, our current materials, our current seals, if they were to mass produce today's stuff right now, it would cost about $250 a kilowatt, okay, to do that. So this means that right now they expect the cost to be a scale-up problem, not a materials problem. Okay, so what I did is I used $1,000 a kilowatt, which I think is conservative. And then I can look at things like levelized cost of electricity. And, you know, NGCC is still the cheapest without a carbon tax, so that's sort of the state of the art. Right now, and that makes sense because natural gas prices are so low that it doesn't matter if we're not as efficient. It's better just to waste more of it, okay, from a profit perspective. But once we start to account for the cost of CO2 under a carbon tax, then the SOFC systems tend to do a lot better economically. Okay, so looking at slide 21, what we can then do is we can try to figure out which system is more profitable under different market conditions. So, for example, we have the price of natural gas on the bottom, and then we have the price of a carbon tax on the top. Okay, so these orange circles are sort of historical points. So today we're almost just under $4 a million BTU. So in the U.S. there's no carbon tax on the whole. EU it's about $9 a ton today. I think yesterday. And it's a 15 for Alberta. Okay, so these are sort of realistic points. And then these colored areas show you which is the most profitable. So right now it's natural gas combined cycle, but we're really close to this boundary where the fuel cell systems are better from a purely profit motivation. Okay, so that has nothing to do with the fact that we can get 100% capture and peaking power with the system. From a pure profit perspective, we're still not far away even then. Okay, and I want to point out that the expected market CO2 price is going to be in the $40 to $60 range. This is argued over, but if we go to a true free market system where we have actual meaningful regulation, that's where they expect it. And then the act of adding compressed air storage, so going from baseline to peaking, is only a 0.1 to 0.3 cents a kilowatt premium. Okay, so for that usability perspective, you pay a very small price, which is really, really cool. Okay, so now that closes out the fuel cell section, and now I want to talk about something else, which called polygeneration. Okay, so this is the idea where we want to make multiple products or use multiple fuels. All right, I'm on slide 23. And the basic premise is that by integrating different kinds of fuels, different kinds of products, there are certain synergies that we can take advantage of. Okay, so I'll go into those. But the idea is by having more to work with, we can integrate. It's just think about heat integration, but it goes a lot farther than that. Okay, and the other thing that we're concerned about is inflexible or agile production. So in the introduction, Larry mentioned a project with BP. So when I had worked with them originally, what they were interested in is the idea that they can change products depending on the market price. So they wanted to build systems where, okay, if natural gas prices are low, let's use more natural gas. Or if I want to make more gasoline now, I would rather do that than methanol. All right, and then they wanted to talk about electricity because they were thinking about systems where I can make a lot of electricity during the daytime, and then maybe I switch to a night mode where I make liquid fuels, okay, where I can store those, and that's sellable later the next day. Okay, so that was the sort of motivating factor, and we did some work. We could show that there's a potential that for some of these plants, you could get over $1 billion in net present value increase just from responding to market prices in real time. So that's what we're talking about. That's the kind of value we have to work with. Okay, so slide 24. So here's a simple example. Well, as simple as you can get, where we're going to take coal and natural gas and convert it to a mixture of liquids and electricity. Okay, so from coal we can gasify. So we basically create syngas or hydrogen and CO. And the idea is that we can use syngas to synthesize methanol or diesel and gasoline. Okay, so when you basically recombine this into the molecule of your choice. Now, the problem with coal is that it doesn't have enough hydrogen for what we need for useful liquid fuels. So what we can do is we can take natural gas, reform that, which basically means more syngas production. And this has a hydrogen, it's very hydrogen rich. So we blend the two and we end up at our sort of middle amount of hydrogen. That's ideal for, you know, Fischer-Tropsch synthesis and that sort of thing, making these transportation fuels. So the idea is we'd like to be able to potentially switch between these fuels someday, maybe divert this syngas to make methanol versus transportation. At the same time, I'd like to be able to divert upstream between liquid fuels and an electricity train. So in this case, I'm using just gas turbines and just syngas combustion. Okay, but the idea is we can switch between using different amounts of natural gas or coal, maybe blend some biomass. And what happens when you do this kind of system compared to a coal only, a gas only, or two unintegrated systems next to each other, this integrated system saves us a lot of energy. Because if I use just coal, for example, I need water gas shift to increase my hydrogen. That means more CO2, wasted carbon atoms, and lost energy. If I use gas to liquids, I have to do CO2 recycle, CO2 reforming, and there's some recompression issues on the recycle, but you get a lot more energy loss there too. But if I integrate the two, I actually eliminate both of those, and I end up with efficiency increases. And I'll show you some data a little bit later. Okay, so on slide 25, here's an example where I can, for example, take my gas turbine system and replace it with a fuel cell-based system. And then what that means is I can then get 100% carbon capture from the power source. Okay, so there's another integration opportunity here. But I'm still combusting my gas turbines because we don't want to put in flexible, you know, changes day and night to my fuel cells. But another option is I can maybe recycle my purge gases to the fuel cells. So these fuel cells are fuel flexible. Okay, so if I'm changing between day and night modes and that kind of thing, I have to be able to build a fuel cell stack that can handle changes in flow rate and composition. Okay, if I can do that, if I'm allowed to from a systems perspective, I can make liquid fuels from coal and natural gas in a flexible way with zero CO2 emissions from the process side. and get drinking water as a result. So we're working on this part with the US DOE because this step here with the fuel cell requires some, it's contentious, so we need to be able to prove this out. So we're working right now with NATL in West Virginia on that. So I don't have any details on that particular one. But going, okay, so there are even more things that we can do. Okay, so we're still talking about integrating coal and gas. And one of the ways we can make it work even better is by looking at the gasifier itself. So here we have a very high temperature, basically partial oxidation of coal. And this runs at 1350 C, roughly. It depends on the model. But essentially, once we do the gasification, the next step is to cool it down to useful temperatures. Okay, I'm on slide, where am I now? 27. Okay, so what happens right now is they use a radiant syngas cooler, which basically means we make high-pressure steam. All right, and what I want to do is instead of making high-pressure steam, I can get much more value if I use natural gas reforming as the coolant. So I take methane and steam, I can make high-value syngas, and this is a very endothermic process, and so what I'm actually doing is I'm integrating these two steps. So I'm using natural gas reforming as the coolant, and what that means is on slide 28, I can build this integrated system where I have coal and natural gas in one unit, I blend the two different kinds of syngas, and then I have a system in which I can make diesel, gasoline, methanol, and power with zero CO2 emissions, potentially. And it's fully integrated, so we have as much exergy captured as possible and minimize the waste of our fuel. Okay, so we're looking at systems like this. So on the next slide, I'm on 29. Let's see here. I just lost my there we go. Okay, here's a look at what happens when you look at the efficiency and how that kind of synergy improves. Okay, so on the bottom, we're showing the percentage of electricity produced as a total of our output. So I can go between very small amounts of electricity or all electricity, all right, depending on how I want to run my plant or build it. And this is showing the operating efficiency for the full system. And at the top, this is showing us that the act of internal reforming, this is my integrated natural gas coal gasifier. All right, we can get up to a 3 percentage point efficiency boost than if we have two systems next to each other. Okay, and we're looking at about 8% over systems that are a single fuel. Okay, so that's what you get out of the integration. We're looking at several percentage points, and that's a big deal on these scales. You know, these are gigawatt level thermal inputs. Okay, and if we add the fuel cells and for carbon capture, that's a 10 percentage point efficiency boost. So that's what integration gives you, and that's why these are really exciting enabling technologies. So if I then go back and I look at the market, so I'm on page 30. So you'll be seeing these plots all over, but again, now I'm showing here's a sensitivity in the natural gas price on the bottom and the average gasoline sale price. This is wholesale price, so it's less than what you have at the pump. But here are, you know, some realistic points. Here's today. And again, this shows you that different systems are better under different prices. And we've been all over the map. Okay, so we have systems where it's this red one means, in the middle means we want to do my integrated system with fuel cells, and we want to have about half power, half electricity produced. Okay, so in this case, it's optimal to produce a mixture of products, which is really interesting. Okay, but all over the place, we have different ones. So the upper left, this means we make all liquid fuels, and we don't do the integrated gasifier reformer. Bottom right means we make all electricity from coal only with fuel cells. Okay, so we're all over the place. So this is where it shows you we want to sort of make this thing that's in the middle here and then be able to flexibly move into these different regions as we go. So this is just showing you, you know, it's a difficult question to say what is the most optimal thing, but that's why I want to do this flexibility. That's why I want to do these integrated systems. Okay. So now I'm on slide, let's see, 31. I'll skip this one, but basically this is the same idea, but now we're looking at tax rates. And again, we're all over the map in terms of what we want to do. Okay. Okay, so I'm on 32 now. So far I've talked about a number of really cool technologies that let us do really neat things with our systems. So we have SOFCs, which let us do zero emissions power. We have compressed air, which lets us augment that for peaking service. We have the integrated coal and natural gas designs, which lets us get really good efficiency increases for the balance of plant. And we integrate all those together, we can get zero emissions out of that process. So now I want to talk about another thing we've just started looking at, which is integrating nuclear systems. Okay, so this is interesting. This came out of an idea from one of the engineers at General Atomics, and they contacted us because they were interested in seeing how they can integrate their technology with the natural gas boom, right? They want to get a piece of it too. So they wanted to see how they can take their, in this case, we're looking at a modular helium reactor. Okay, it's a generation 4. It's been tested, I think, 60 years ago. They have a pilot plant for this that works. But we're looking at, you know, 10, 20 years out before anything would be built. Okay, so it's sort of the next generation to come through. And the way it's basically just a really high-temperature reactor. I'm on slide 34. Okay, high-temperature reactor. So where we use helium as the coolant. So we get about 1,200 degrees C helium at high pressure, and then we just run this through gas turbine. Okay, that's how we get our electricity, and then we cool, recompress, and then reheat again. Okay, so it's just a Brayton cycle with helium. All right, itself isn't that exciting from or new, like we're used to these kinds of systems, but it's CO2 free, right? Nuclear energy is incredibly high energy density, and there's no CO2 whatsoever. Okay. Now, what we wanted to do is we're going to, again, look at the idea of exergy, and we say, okay, it actually might be better to use this high temperature for steam reforming of methane, and then our waste heat is still at 950 C, so we can still get lots of power out. Okay, but now we have an integrated, natural gas nuclear system. Okay, so what we can do, I'm going backwards to slide 33, is we can make a system that uses coal gasification and natural gas, but now our reforming is going to be powered by nuclear heat. Okay, and so this is really interesting. So in this case, we're looking at just liquid production. We have power from the natural gas part, which is off the sheet. I'm sorry, from the nuclear part, which is off the sheet. We have a steam cycle from waste heat. But basically, we want to make liquid fuels. And that's what this is saying. We're going to again do coal and natural gas blending. In this case, we can recycle our light gases. And the idea is this nuclear heat is going to drive the reforming process, which is actually a very significant energy sink normally. Okay, so I'm going to slide 35. And from this kind of system, here we're looking at CO2 emissions per 1,000 gallons of gasoline equivalent. Okay, and we're accounting for both direct and indirect emissions here. And basically, okay, on the far right, this is coal to liquid. So if you're going to do a synthetic fuels, this would be like Sasol in South Africa. We're looking at, 12.5 tons per 1,000 gallons we produce. With the nuclear and coal natural gas system, we're down to 2.6, and that's without carbon capture. So adding the nuclear drops it in half just from coal and gas, and we're way down from the existing system with coal only. And once we add carbon capture, we can basically essentially get zero emissions. So case 1, 2, 3, and 4, these are just different design options. But one of these, we can actually get zero emissions effectively. Okay, we don't need the SOFCs, so we can get around those problems. But this is also really, really cool. So this is just for the liquids. Okay, and then, I'm not turning here. Let's see, slide. Yeah, so now I'm on 36. Here we go. Okay, the other thing I want to point out is the carbon efficiency. All right, I haven't mentioned this yet, but the carbon efficiency is the percentage of carbon atoms that end up in the fuel. Okay, so compared to coal to liquids, we're showing where the carbon ends up. So for traditional coal to liquids, 33%, only 33% ends up as diesel or gasoline. The rest of it is waste. So if we did carbon capture, 60% we'd be able to capture, and then the remaining 6 is emitted to the atmosphere. So what ends up happening is with this coal and gas and nuclear to liquids, we go up to a 72% carbon efficiency. And that is really, really high for synthetic fuels. Okay, and so I get really excited about this because if we're looking forward to the future, prices might be low now. They may or may not be low in the future, but we are depleting. They are going to go down. As we find more, it doesn't matter. Eventually, we're going to start being very concerned about getting the most out of every bit of fuel that we get, okay? So we want to maximize not just our efficiencies, but how much, the carbon goes. I mean, the fuel is more than just an energy source, it's a carbon source. Okay, so this is a really cool way of, maximizing that. And As a result, what's really cool is that for all the gasoline you produce, 20% of that energy came from the uranium. Okay, so from Canada's perspective, we have a lot of uranium. We have, I think, one mine in Saskatchewan. I can't remember now. I think it's about 250 years supply, just from that one mine. And from Canada, from a political perspective, they are very nuclear enabled. In Ontario, half of our power comes from nuclear, and it's a government priority to try to capitalize on this. But we can't export our uranium, and so what they're trying to do, the only thing they really can do, is they can build one of our Canadian, it's called CANDU, just one of our particular Canadian designs, and license that operation in other friendly countries. But we can really capitalize on our existing resources because we can use our uranium to produce gasoline, and so we can transport that, we can ship that, we can sell it, and we have no proliferation concerns. Okay, so that eliminates a huge problem in terms of capitalizing on our resources. So that's something that I get really excited about. Okay, so if I switch over to page 37, all right, again, we're looking at the market. Here we have natural gas and CO2 emissions again. And basically, I want to point out that, okay, the Alberta line, this blue region means that coal and gas only would be optimal for liquid fuels, but we're really close to this beige and the red regions, which are different designs with coal, gas, and nuclear. Okay, so even from a monetary perspective, we're really close. All right, so for the future, this is something to be considered seriously, with all the as long as all the other nuclear-related problems are considered. Okay, so that's one more technology I wanted to bring into play. So just, how is that going to play out in the future? And so the last one I want to look at, I'm on slide 38 now, is chemical looping. All right, so slide 39. This is basically a way of oxidizing fuel where we don't do it in air. Again, the whole point is to try to get nitrogen out of the picture. Okay, so what we do is we take nickel, there's other metals we can use, and we oxidize that. So we basically pull the oxygen out of the air and put on nickel oxide. So we're basically rusting it, essentially. We cycle in that, separate it out. So we get nickel oxide, and then we send that into our reducer section, and then we oxidize our fuel using nickel oxide as the oxidant. Okay, and then our nickel then can be recycled. Okay, so that's called the chemical loop because we're looping this metal. And what this does is there's two things. One, we can basically get complete oxidation at high pressure and temperature, and so we have a lot of waste heat, which we can use in a steam cycle for power. Okay, so 700 C. But the other thing is we get CO2 and water again. Again, no nitrogen, so it's an easy separation. All right, so that's sort of the point, is if we do chemical looping, we can get CO2 out very easily. And then we have this high-pressure, high-temperature depleted air, so we get a lot of Brayton cycle power out of that as well. Okay, so this is another major technology that lets us produce power with low CO2 to zero CO2 emissions, because, again, we can capture all of that, using something where the point is to not let nitrogen come into the picture. Okay, and there's more we can do with this technology. So slide 40, here's an example with iron. Okay, iron, we have multiple oxidation states. So what we can do with this is here I have fully oxidized iron, and I can oxidize my fuel, produce my high-temperature CO2 water like before. But what happens then is I have really hot, reduced iron, and it's a energy carrier in the form of heat, and I can use that to reform steam, which basically means I'm going to strip the oxygen out of water and make hydrogen. Okay, so I can make hydrogen, and then I have this partially oxidized iron as a product, and then I can fully oxidize that with air. Okay, and then that's the loop. So what I get is power and hydrogen. Okay, so that's just another really interesting energy product we can get out of it. So one of the things we're looking at right now is, okay, slide 41. Yeah, I'm not going to go through this in great detail, but basically we're looking at an integrated polygeneration system. All right, we're trying to use a nickel oxide loop for power, an iron oxide loop to produce hydrogen, and our goal is to make, in this case, dimethyl ether, but we can make diesel gasoline if you want. We're just sort of shaking things up in terms of the fuels we can produce. Okay, so in this case, we use coal as the primary source, and we have two different gasifiers. The first one produces a higher hydrogen content because we want to use that in our iron oxide loop to make hydrogen. And the second one produces syngas, which we want to use to make liquid fuels. And we use the hydrogen to upgrade our syngas so we get the right amount of hydrogen content so we can make methanol and dimethyl ether. All right, and we're going to make power then as a secondary product through nickel oxide loop and steam turbines. And we can blend in any amount between zero and a large percentage of natural gas as an option, and then we can optionally use nuclear heat if we wanted to power that reforming process. So we have a lot of different fuels we can do, and this, what you're looking at, represents a superstructure where we can do carbon capture, many different combinations of fuels, and different products as well. Okay, so with that, we can take a look, slide 42. Okay, this is an example if I used it for just power. All right, so we're showing thermal efficiencies here. On the left, all the white bars are standard existing processes. So Shell and GE, these are different kinds of IGCC, different pulverized coal, so sort of traditional stuff, natural gas combined cycle. And then this shows you, like, for coal only, we're much more efficient than the other coal-based processes. Right, and as we blend in more natural gas or nuclear energy, our efficiency keeps going up higher and higher. And this is all with maximum carbon capture capability. So just from an efficiency perspective, it tends to be better. And then as we add liquid fuel, so here's an example where I make half power, half liquids, the efficiency, the same kind of thing, basically integrating these systems, you bring up the efficiency. Now, that's a little dubious because the natural gas is already more efficient. So what really matters is going to be that cost analysis in the end of the day. And that's actually in progress because we're still working on that right now. Okay, so I'm gonna sum it all up here. I'm on the last slide, 43. So basically what I try to bring to your attention are a bunch of different technologies which enable us to do great things with a system. Okay, so just to recap, we had solid oxide fuel cells. So that lets us do high-efficiency power from fossils. And because we don't bring nitrogen into the picture, that lets CO2 capture be really easy. We can get 100% capture, zero emissions. Compressed air storage that lets us integrate with the fuel cells. We can get load-following power on very realistic scales using real data, okay, without anything special. So it's a great integration option. We can use coal and gas and integrate them together to make liquid fuels, all right, and that makes a lot of balance of plant benefits. And it's actually very cost-effective, and we can do that through tightly integrating in a gasifier or through indirectly integrating by blending. We can link in fuel cells to that if we want to have power and liquids together and still get no emissions. Here we have an example of nuclear energy. So how do we integrate nuclear energy, carbonless energy, into our system? And again, we could show how carbon efficiency has really improved, and we still have zero emissions, and this is for liquids and power. And then chemical looping, this is a totally different approach, but again, we can get CO2 and water separation, basically giving us zero emissions at little penalty. Okay, so the point of my group is we're looking at everything, right? We're trying to identify what are the technologies we want to investigate in, where are the real key technologies of the future, and what can we do with those to make that happen from a systems perspective. So with that, I'll just close and acknowledge funding sources and the rest of my team. I didn't talk about biofuels because I think you guys have covered that plenty in the ESI seminar, but they do consider another aspect because we do look at the renewables perspective as well, and not just fossil, so I don't want to give you that impression. Okay, and with that, I'll thank you guys very much for your attention, and hopefully we can do questions over the conference call.
Okay, thank you very much, Tom. Okay, maybe if I could ask people to unmute their mics, and if there are questions, maybe we can take the first ones over the web. Any questions out there?
Yeah, hey, Larry. Yes. Wiley Busey here calling.
Yeah, hi, Wiley.
Hey, I just had a question about the gas, the compressed air storage, you know, where you would take energy and electrical energy and you compress it and put it in a cavern and then it comes right back out. That whole loop where you, compress and then decompress, how efficient is that? Or are we still kind of working on that to improve that?
Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm going slow here. Okay. Yeah, so directly doing it
by itself is pretty, there's a lot of inefficiencies to it. So you lose, I mean, you're losing energy by doing compression. You lose energy, you can see, just from pulling heat out, and this is more lower grade heat. And then you have to add more natural gas anyway to get this to work in the normal system. So I don't know the number off the top of my head, to be honest, in terms of efficiency. I will say that this does work, but on the other hand, there are only two plants working for this. So I don't expect it to actually be that profitable, and in part due to that efficiency loss. The storage itself is pretty elastic, so once you're in the cavern, you're not losing a lot of energy over time. And we actually store it at like 25 C, so we don't really have heat losses from that. From our perspective, we have, you know, the synergy comes from the fact that we don't have to spend extra electricity from the grid to do that. We can just pull it right off our own system. And we already have the compressed air mostly compressed. So I do need an additional compressor. But the compression ratio is like 2 versus 40 to 80 at this point. So it is more efficient from the synergy. And the other thing is I don't have to burn natural gas when I pull it out again because I already have lots of plenty of waste heat here I can use. Okay, so we are accounting for that emission, for that efficiency loss. Now, of course, any benefits, you would get benefits by improving the system. Our point is it's good enough now. But, you know, obviously if you were able to do things that improve it, that would help help a bit.
Okay. Other questions out there? Okay. If not, Alex, you have a question?
So I read in the news recently that it's foreseen 20, 30, 40 years, we're going to have a really big helium shortage. And you're talking about this nuclear technology that you really wouldn't implement. 20 years from now. Are there other nuclear reactor technologies that you could get about the same benefit with that might not have that issue? Is that a concern?
Okay, everyone heard the question. Good. Okay.
Okay, I think the question, just to repeat it because I could kind of hear you, but you were basically you brought up the point that helium we might face a shortage in a couple decades, and you were wondering if there are alternative ways we could use nuclear without the helium. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, great question. First of all, in this case, the helium's in a loop, so it's closed loop. So we're not consuming helium on a regular basis. So that's this would not be a regular consumer of it. We might need a lot at one point, but we're not, you know, over time, we're not continuously removing it. But essentially, any high-temperature heat source will work. So the other thing we're looking at is other kinds of fourth generation, including molten salt. So molten salt reactors are another kind of... Fourth generation is basically has to do with safety, but it also means that we're okay with going to higher temperatures than we do with, like, boiling water reactors and that kind of thing. And so we can still get 1,200 C with molten salt. I think actually maybe 1,000 C. Okay, so we're looking at that. That's actually one of the next products we're going to go do. And so molten salt, basically you use molten salt as a coolant. And there's a safety advantage because if, for example, there's a has a really low vapor pressure, so the likelihood of it vaporizing, the temperatures have to be so astronomically high that it doesn't really happen. So that's why they like molten salt from a safety perspective. But yeah, and I don't have the numbers as to how efficient or less efficient it would be. The challenge would be in the reforming. So if we can't go up to 1200 C, we can only go up to 1000. We'd have to drop the natural gas pressure to get the reforming done. But you're looking at a small efficiency loss, but the process itself would still function.
Okay, very good. Do we have any other questions? If not, Tom, thank you very much for a great seminar. We're going to post these slides on the web. And do you have sound?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have sound. And we have the audio as well. So, again, thank you very much, Tom. And I'll keep you in the loop about others as well. Thanks again. Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.